Citizen Soldiers, Disc 3.
The U.S. Army Air Ground Team in ETO continued to improve through to the end of the war. Its communication system was vastly superior to anything the Germans ever developed. Meanwhile, the 8th Air Force B-17s continued to pound away at communications targets in France, particularly bridges and railroads, as did the Marauders of 9th Air Force. But weather continued through July to hamper the effectiveness of the Allied Air Forces. 50% of the missions in July, for all planes in England and France, had to be scrubbed because of weather. The Luftwaffe in Normandy was pathetic. The sole contribution Field Marshal Goering's pilots made to the battle came at night, when one, two, or sometimes a dozen Luftwaffe bombers flew over the beaches, dropped bombs at random, and got out of there as soon as possible. The Americans called the night visitors Bedcheck Charlies. Every weapon on the beach was fired at the bombers. The tracers made such a dazzling array, the Germans named the beaches Golden City. The Luftwaffe did little damage, except to nerves. On the ground, the Americans continued to advance, slowly, but all along the front, except at Saint-Lô. Outside Saint-Lô, more or less stuck in place for nearly a month, despite many attacks, was the 29th Division. Since D-Day, it had been locked in a mortal embrace with the 352nd Division. But in each division, there was scarcely a man present for duty who had been there on D-Day. The 352nd, in fact, had virtually disappeared. In the 29th, General Charles Gerhardt, the CO, was referred to as a corps commander rather than a division commander. He has a division in the field, a division in the hospital, and a division in the cemetery. The historian of the 29th, Joseph Balkowski, has a well-deserved tribute to the soldiers of the Blue and Gray Division. The 29ers were humble men caught up in a war of immeasurable complexity. Most 29ers had done what they were told to do, even when orders made little sense. On the deadly battlefields from Omaha Beach to Saint-Lô, these simple acts of obedience reflected astounding personal courage. Any soldier who could bring himself to leap over a hedgerow upon command and race hunchbacked across a grassy field while bullets snapped over his head like cracking whips was a brave man indeed. Some of the fiercest fighting was taking place outside Saint-Lô. To its defense, the Germans devoted much of their strength, as Major Randall Bryant of the 9th Division discovered in mid-July when he was walking across an orchard with his closest friend, Captain Charles Minton, beside him. The Germans laid on a TOT, time on target, an artillery chute carefully coordinated to concentrate the fire of an entire battery or regiment on one spot at a precise moment. Bryant and Minton happened to be at the spot. "Suddenly everything was exploding," Bryant related. "There was blood all over me and a helmet on the ground with a head inside it. It was Minton's. Three young second lieutenants had just joined us straight from the beach and Fort Benning. I had told them to sit down and wait to be assigned to companies. They were dead, along with six others killed and 33 wounded, in a chute that lasted only a matter of seconds." Gerhardt was under great pressure from Bradley to take Saint-Lô. So far, he had already lost more men outside Saint-Lô than he had on Omaha Beach on D-Day. His medics were measuring gains by morphine units dispensed. One of them commented that he figured it took 32 grains of morphine per hedgerow. The 29th's rifle companies were close to 100% replacements. But Gerhardt figured the Germans were in worse condition, and he ordered a general assault to take Saint-Lô, putting all his strength into it. No reserves. Major Tom Howey, a mild-mannered teacher of English literature before the war, led the 3rd Battalion of the 116th Regiment in the 29th. Linked to the 2nd Battalion, he was to drive right on into Saint-Lô. On July 17th, an hour before dawn, the attack began. Howey told his men to keep going no matter what. He limited each platoon to 2 men firing their rifles, and then only in emergency. The others were to use their bayonets and hand grenades. The idea was to achieve surprise. The tactics had been developed by the star-crossed 90th Division, which had been unlucky in its COs. 3 had already been relieved by Bradley, and had suffered by this time 100% casualties among its enlisted men, and 150% among its officers. One of them was D-Day hero General Teddy Roosevelt, Jr. On July 13th, Bradley replaced the CO of the 90th with Roosevelt, but Roosevelt died that night of a heart attack. One regiment had been losing its platoon leaders at the rate of 48% a week. To cut the losses, the 90th had gone over to night attacks, infiltrating by squads independently without artillery preparation. This worked. As one 90th Division GI put it, "We learned to prefer the night infiltration attack. It was a lot better to fight the German by surprise than to carry out the normal daylight assault." In the pre-dawn July 17th attack, the infantry from the 29th broke through, or passed through, the German line and took the high ground just 1 kilometer from Saint-Lô. The road into the city was open. Howey called the company commanders to a conference and to give them their objectives. "We had just finished the meeting," Captain William Puntini, Howey's executive officer, recalled. "The COs had been dismissed, and before they could get back to their companies, the Germans began dropping a mortar barrage around our ears. Before taking cover in one of the foxholes, Major Howey turned to take a last look to be sure all his men had their heads down. Without warning, one of the shells hit a few yards away. A fragment struck the Major in the back and pierced his lung. 'My God, I'm hit,' he murmured, and I saw he was bleeding at the mouth. As he fell, I caught him. He was dead in 2 minutes." Captain Puntineni took over, just as a counterattack from the Fallschirmjäger hit the battalion. Using the new communications techniques, the 29th called in artillery and a fighter-bomber strike. It broke up the attack and restored the spirits of Howey's men. They began the charge into Saint-Lô. In the opinion of Captain Cooper, "It was an almost perfect use of combined arms of air, armor, infantry, and artillery, working in joint optimum support of each other." As they crested the hill and started the descent into the town, the Americans were shocked by what they saw. Saint-Lô had been hit by B-17s on D-Day, and every clear day thereafter. The center of the place was a lifeless pile of rubble, in which roads and sidewalks could scarcely be distinguished, as Balkoski notes. As they moved into the fringe of town, they began to draw German fire from some Fallschirmjäger in a cemetery. A macabre battle ensued, rifle and machine gun bullets smashing into headstones. Rhino tanks that had busted through the hedgerow came up in support, fired their cannons and machine guns, and drove the Germans off. The men of the 29th dashed into the town, guns blazing. There was still hard fighting to go before the town was completely cleared of the enemy, but finally Saint-Lô was in American hands. At Gerhardt's insistence, Howey's body was put on a jeep and driven into the town. Men from the 3rd Battalion draped the body with the stars and stripes and hoisted it on top of a huge pile of stones that had once been a wall in the St. Croix Church, a block from the cemetery. Howey's body remained on display through the next day, July 19th. GIs and some of the few civilians remaining in the town adorned the site with flowers. "It was simple and direct," no fanfare or otherwise, Lieutenant Edward Jones recollected. The story caught on with the press. Life magazine featured the Major of San Lo. Howie was famous, too late to do him any good, but what he and the other officers and men of the 29th had done was far more important than good publicity for the Army. They had captured the town, and with it, the high ground in that part of Normandy, thereby putting First Army in a position to launch an offensive designed to break through the German line and out of the hedgerow country. For that offensive, Bradley was making plans to use the Allies' greatest single asset, air power. Undaunted by what had happened in Goodwood, he was preparing to use every bomber and fighter bomber that could fly in a crushing bombardment that would blast a hole in the German line. Chapter 3. Breakout and Encirclement. July 25th through August 25th, 1944. On July 24th, 7 weeks after D-Day, U.S. First Army was holding an east-west line that ran from Caumont to Saint-Lô to Lassay on the Channel. Pre-D-Day projections had put the Americans on this line on D plus 5. Disappointing as that was, Bradley could see opportunities for his army. The enemy, although nearly equal in number of fighting men, was sadly deficient in supplies and badly worn down. One of Bradley's chief problems was he had not enough room to bring the well-trained and equipped divisions waiting in England into the battle, not to mention General Patton. For the Germans, the problem was the opposite. No significant reinforcements were available. Another favorable factor for Bradley, 6 of the 8 German panzer divisions in Normandy faced the British and Canadians around Caen. Bradley was also encouraged by 2 sets of photographs shown to him by General Quesada. One showed the area behind the German lines. The roads were empty. The other showed the area behind American lines. The roads were nose-to-tail armor and transport convoys or marching troops. Huge supply dumps dotted the fields, with no need for camouflage. These were among the fruits of air superiority. The 9th Tactical Air Force had a dozen airstrips in Normandy by this time. Pilots could be over their targets in a matter of minutes. They were daredevil youngsters, some of them only 19 years of age. It was generally felt that by the time he reached his mid-20s, a man was too sensible to take the chances routinely required of a P-47 pilot. They lived in tents in the Norman mud. They made up to 5 sorties per day, some of them only 20 minutes in duration. They dominated the sky and brought destruction to the Germans below. Another plus for Bradley, his men were much better equipped for the battle than they had been when the campaign began, both in weapons and tactics. By July 24th, 3 of 5 First Army tanks had been fitted with a Rhino. Ground-air communications were improving daily. Bradley had ruthlessly relieved incompetent division commanders, sometimes with indifferent results, but sometimes seeing marked improvement. The frontline soldiers were a mix of veterans and replacements, with relatively good morale, although, like the Germans, badly worn down. A heartening thing for the GIs, First Army had reached the limits of the worst of the hedgerow country. Beyond lay fertile, rolling countryside. The hedgerows enclosed larger pastures. Roads were more numerous. Many were tarred. A few were even 4-lane. The front line ran on or close to the Saint-Lô-Perrier Road, which was a straight east-west paved highway, the N-800. Between Saint-Lô and Perrier, the Panzer Lehr Division, badly used up, held the line for the Germans. Facing Panzer Lehr on the American side were the 9th, 4th, and 30th Divisions. Bradley decided he could use the Saint-Lô-Perrier Road as a marker for the strategic air forces and lay a carpet of bombs on Panzer Lehr by having the bombers fly parallel to the road. A landmark they couldn't miss, Bradley reasoned. The area to be obliterated was 6 kilometers long, running along the road, and 2 kilometers south of the road. Massed artillery would come after the bombardment, followed by a combined tank infantry assault 3 divisions strong. If it worked, the Americans would break out of the hedgerow country and uncover the entire German left wing in Normandy, with Patton's Third Army ready to come in to exploit a breakthrough. Bradley gave the operation the code name Cobra. He began planning it in mid-July and was ready to go by the 21st, but bad weather caused delays. Meanwhile, there was a dispute over how close to the road the attacking units of the American divisions ought to be placed. Bradley wanted them within 800 meters of the road, serving as a bomb line. The airmen wanted a buffer zone of 3 kilometers. Eventually, they compromised at 1,200 meters. That caused a number of infantry units to have to pull back from the road, giving up ground won at such a cost, something they hated to do. On July 21st, Eisenhower flew in a heavy rain from London to Normandy to be present for the attack. Bradley met him and said the attack had been called off. Then he dressed Eisenhower down for flying in such weather. Eisenhower tossed away his soggy cigarette, grinned, and said his only pleasure in being Supreme Commander was that nobody could ground him. "When I die," he added, looking at the steady rain, "they ought to hold my body for a rainy day and then bury me out in the middle of a storm. This damned weather is going to be the death of me yet." On July 24th, the weather appeared acceptable, and an order to go went out to the airfields, only to be rescinded after a third of the force had taken off. By the time the recall signal had gone out to the bombers, 1 flight of B-17s had crossed the coast and released its load of 500-pound bombs through cloud cover. Most of the bombs fell short, causing casualties in the 30th Division and leaving the infantrymen madder than hell. Worse, the bombers had come in perpendicular to the line, not on a parallel course. The airmen argued that they couldn't funnel all the bombers involved through the narrow corridor created by using a single marker and flying along it. It would take hours for them all to pass over the target, all the time exposed to anti-aircraft fire from the 88s. By coming in perpendicular, spread out, the bombers would cause a much greater shock on the German side and only be taking flak during the seconds it took to cross the line and drop the bombs. Bradley still wanted a parallel approach, but the airmen convinced him that it was too late to change the plan. July 25th was clear. At 09:38, some 550 fighter bombers appeared. They were being guided by radio messages from forward air controllers riding in tanks at the head of armored columns. The FACs could talk simultaneously to ground units, P-47s, higher headquarters, and supporting artillery batteries. The P-47s fired rockets and machine guns on the German positions just south of the road and dropped 500-pound bombs that were much more powerful than even 240-millimeter howitzers and could be placed by the pilots within 300 meters of the American lines. Most GIs feared artillery preparation closer than 500 meters. Reporter Ernie Pyle wrote, "The dive bombers hit it just right. We stood in the barnyard of a French farm and watched them barrel nearly straight down out of the sky. They were bombing less than a half a mile ahead of where we stood. They came in groups, diving from every direction, perfectly timed, one right after another. Everywhere you looked, separate groups of planes were on the way down, or on the way back up, or slanting over for a dive." After 20 minutes, the P-47s gave way to 1,800 B-17s. Their appearance left men groping for words to describe it. Pyle did it this way. A new sound gradually droned into our ears, a gigantic, faraway surge of doom-like sound. It was the heavies. They came from directly behind us. They came on in flights of 12, three flights to a group, and in groups stretched out across the sky. Their march across the sky was slow and studied. I've never known anything that had about it the aura of such a ghastly relentlessness. You had the feeling that even had God appeared beseechingly before them in the sky with palms outward to persuade them to turn back, they would not have had within them the power to turn off their irresistible course. They were 12,000 feet high. General Fritz Bayerlein compared the flight to a conveyor belt. Lieutenant James DeLong, a pilot in a B-26 coming behind the B-17s, had been on 66 missions. He declared flatly, "I have never seen so many planes altogether strung out across the sky. Smoke rose from the bomb explosions high into the sky. Loud and frequent commands came over the radio not to drop short of the smoke line." Captain Belton Cooper was on the ground. "Once they started, it was like some giant prehistoric dragon snake forming a long, great continuum across the sky, with its tail extended over the horizon. I was reminded of Leonidas in the Battle of Thermopylae, when he was told that the Persian arrows were so numerous they would darken the sky. He said, 'Good, so much the better. We can fight in the shade.'" The B-17s were overhead for a full hour. Their strike saturated the area just south of the road to a depth of 2,500 meters. The results for the Germans were near catastrophic. The bombed area looked like the surface of the moon. Craters had overlapped each other in many areas. Entire hedgerows were blasted away. General Bayerlein reported that he lost at least 70% of my troops, out of action, dead, wounded, crazed, or numbed. During the second half hour of the bombardment, the bomb line, as seen from 11,000 feet, moved north. The dust and debris raised by the first waves was drifting on a south wind. The CO of Company B, 8th Infantry, 4th Division, described what happened. "The dive bombers came in beautifully, dropped their bombs right in front of us, just where they belonged. Then the first group of heavies dropped theirs. The next wave came in closer, the next one closer, still closer. Then they came right on top of us. The shock was awful. I called battalion and told them I was in no condition to move out, that everything was completely disorganized, and it would take me some time to get my men back together, and asked for a delay." There were 111 GIs killed and 490 wounded by the shorts. Among the dead was General Leslie McNair, chief of the Army Ground Forces, who was in the front lines to witness the attack. Ernie Pyle wrote that it was impossible to describe what anyone under those bombs felt or thought. "I believe a person's feelings at such times are kaleidoscopic and uncatalogable. You just wait, that's all. You do remember an inhuman tenseness of muscle and nerves." Pyle was stiff and sore for days after because of muscles tensing themselves too tight for too long. This bombardment was supplemented by artillery fire, 1,000 guns in all. The gunners' initial task was to suppress all German anti-aircraft fire. When the first wave of bombers appeared, 88s knocked three of them out of the sky. But little Piper Cubs were flying near enough to the German lines to spot the flashes and call in the German battery's positions to American artillery. Medic Edward Buddy Gianoloni was struck by the sight. "The funniest thing I ever saw was those Piper Cubs. They were spotting for the artillery so the 88s couldn't hit our bombers. Little bitsy Piper Cub protecting these great big sons of bitches way up there with the bombs." When the shells started coming down on them, the German artillerymen dove into their bunkers, and the 88 anti-aircraft fire ceased. Beierlein estimated that he lost half his 88s. Then, in a general hour-long barrage, the GIs fired 50,000 artillery shells. Overhead, as the B-17s departed, 350 P-47s swooped in for another 20-minute strike against the narrow strip just south of the road, dropping napalm-filled drums on the target. Their departure from the area was the signal for the infantry and tanks to begin the ground attack. As they did so, 396 Marauders hit the rear of the German front line. Altogether, some 16,000 tons of bombs hit the Germans, supplemented by the artillery barrage. It was the greatest expenditure of explosives for a single attack in the Army's history. The effect on the Germans was not far short of disaster. Private Herbert Meyer, a radioman, recalled, "So many planes over so little space, and the bombs rained down." He was ordered to carry a message to an artillery commander in a bunker. "Getting out of my hole, I saw the bombs being released, and the way they shone in the sun for a moment, then fell to earth so fast that one could not see them. The explosions sent great geysers of earth into the air. I ran from hole to hole like a rabbit, then into the bunker and delivered my message." Everywhere there was death and destruction. Men not hit by shrapnel were bleeding from the nose, ears, mouth. The world seemed to be coming to an end. For Major Joachim Barth, CO of an anti-tank battalion in Beierlein's division, it almost had. "When the shelling finally stopped," he recalled, "I looked out of my bunker. The world had changed. There were no leaves on the trees. It was much harder to get around. We had wounded. We needed medics, but no ambulances could come forward. Our big guns had been tipped over." The Americans had suffered, too, and when Bradley got the news of the Shorts, he wrote that at his headquarters, "Dejection settled over us like a wet fog." But he remained determined to take immediate advantage of the shock to the Germans. He sent his energy down the line. "Let's go." The company CO of the 4th Division, who had asked for a delay before jumping off so that he could reorganize his shattered troops, was told, "No, push off. Jump off immediately." Lieutenant Sidney Eichen of the 30th Division had a similar experience. "My outfit was decimated," he reported. "Our anti-tank guns blown apart. I saw one of our truck drivers, Jesse Ivy, lying split down the middle. Captain Bell was buried in a crater." But his division CO, General William Harrison, put the pressure on Eichen's regimental commander. "Colonel, the attack goes ahead as scheduled. Even if you have only two or three men, the attack is to be made." The colonel ran from company to company, shouting, "You've got to get going! Get going!" So Eichen said, "Half-heartedly, we started to move." On the German side, Major Barth remembered that as the shelling stopped, he told his men, "Get ready, get ready." They were digging people out, digging out the guns and righting them. "Get ready, get ready. Prepare your positions. They'll soon be here." And then, finally, the release. "They're coming, they're coming." Everyone knew what he had to do. There were no orders to be given. It was our lance corporals who supplied the nerve, and they're the ones I admire. They knew their duty and did it. We old soldiers always said the lance corporals were the backbone of the army. The first advancing GIs passed disabled German vehicles, shattered corpses, and stunned and disoriented survivors. But they also found veterans of the Panzer Lehr, doing business at the same old stand with the same old merchandise, dug in tanks and infantry. Private Gunther Feldmann of Panzer Lehr, later a POW who learned English, recalled that the first words I heard from an American were, "God damn it all, the bastards are still there." He meant my division. German artillery fire on the GIs was also heavy, as some, at least, of the dug-in German artillery survived. As darkness came on July 25th, little or no gain had resulted from the airstrike. Cobra looked to be another Goodwood. But if the GIs and their generals were discouraged, General Beierlein was in despair. When a staff officer came from Army headquarters conveying Field Marshal von Kluge's order that the Saint-Lô-Perrier line must be held, that not a single man should leave his position, Beierlein replied, "Out in front, everyone is holding out. Everyone! My grenadiers and my engineers and my tank crews, they're all holding their ground. Not a single man is leaving his post. They are lying silent in their foxholes, for they are dead. You may report to the field marshal that the Panzerlehr division is annihilated." July 26th was a day of suspense. The Americans attacked, throwing divisions scheduled for exploitation into the battle to break through. The Germans held nonetheless. The break came on July 27th. The thin crust of Panzerlehr disintegrated. Sergeant Hans Strober noted that the Americans had learned how to break through, ignoring their flanks and pushing through to occupy crossroads and set up blocking positions so that our vehicles and heavy weapons could not get through. The breakthrough was a great feat of arms. First Army had accomplished something that had been nearly impossible in 1914 through 1918, and not achieved by the British in front of Caen in June-July 1944. First Army had accomplished something that it had not been trained or equipped to do, in the process developing an air-ground team unmatched in the world. Now, along with Third Army, it was finally going to get into a campaign for which it had been trained and equipped. The Dean of American Military Historians, Russell Wigley, referring to the flow of GIs that poured around the German open flank, wrote in his classic study, Eisenhower's Lieutenants, "This virtual road march was war such as the American Army was designed for, especially the American Armored Divisions, appealing also to the passion for moving on that is so much a part of the American character and heritage. It brought out the best in the troops, their energy and mechanical resourcefulness. Now that Cobra had achieved the breakout, the most mobile army in the world, for the first time since D-Day, could capitalize on its mobility." Wigley further notes that with the hard-won mobility, the issues confronting the army became, for the first time in Europe, strategic rather than tactical. The soldiers' Battle of Normandy was about to become the generals' Battle of France. With the German left flank in the air and the Allies facing an open road to Paris, Patton was activated and all his pent-up energy turned loose. He had come over in time for Cobra to familiarize himself with the situation and to set up Third Army headquarters. He took command of one of the corps already in Normandy and had other divisions coming in from England. When Third Army was activated, General Courtney Hodges succeeded Bradley as First Army commander, while Bradley moved up to command 12th Army Group, First and Third Armies. By August 1st, he had divisions attacking in four directions. Meanwhile, First Army pressed forward to the south as German resistance collapsed. As the general German retreat began, the American air-ground team pounded the enemy. The Wehrmacht was out of the hedgerows, out in the open, trying desperately to move by day to get away. Patton's tanks mauled them. The Jabos terrorized them. "I had seen the first retreat from Moscow," Sergeant Helmut Gunther of the 17th SS Panzer Grenadiers recalled, which was terrible enough, but at least units were still intact. Here we had become a cluster of individuals. We were not a battle-worthy company any longer. All that we had going for us was that we knew each other very well. The P-47s responded to calls from the tankers and infantry over the radio, descended on their targets, and hit them with napalm, 500-pound bombs, rockets, and 50-caliber machine gun fire. Destroyed German tanks, trucks, scout cars, wagons, and artillery pieces, along with dead and wounded horses and men, covered the landscape. Captain Cooper described the Allied teamwork. When two Panther tanks threatened his maintenance company from across a hedgerow, the liaison officer and a Sherman got on its radio to give the coordinates to any Yabos in the area. Within less than 45 seconds, two P-47s appeared right over the treetops, traveling like hell at 300 feet. They let go their bombs 1,000 feet short of Cooper's location. It seemed like the bombs were going to land square in the middle of our area. He and his men dove into their foxholes. The bombs went screaming over. The P-47s came screaming in right behind them, firing their 8 50-caliber machine guns. The bombs hit a German ammunition dump. The blast was awesome. Flames and debris shot some 500 feet into the air. There were bogey wheels, tank tracks, helmets, backpacks, and rifles flying in all directions. The hedgerow between us and the German tanks protected us from the major direct effects of the blast. However, the tops of the trees were sheared off, and a tremendous amount of debris came down on us. "I have been to 2 church socials and a county fair," said one P-47 pilot, "but I never saw anything like this before." The Yabos were merciless. The constant attacks inevitably broke up German units, which had a terrible effect on morale. A theme that always comes up when interviewing German veterans is comradeship. So too with American veterans, of course. But there is an intensity about the Germans on the subject that is unique. One reason is that generally German squads were made up of men from the same town or region, so the men had known each other as children. Another is the experience of being caught in a debacle. Yabos overhead, artillery raining down, tanks firing from the rear. Corporal Bertenroth spoke to the point. "The worst thing that could happen to a soldier was to be thrown into some group in which he knew no one. In our unit, we would never abandon each other. We had fought in Russia together. We were comrades and always came to the rescue. We protected our comrades so they could go home to their wives, children, and parents. That was our motivation. The idea that we would conquer the world had fallen long ago." Lieutenant Walter Padberg of Grenadier Regiment 959 was appalled. "Everything was chaos. Allied artillery and airplanes were everywhere." Then the worst possible happened. "I did not know any of the people around me." Patberg continued fleeing, essentially on his own, even though in the midst of others. The retreat was turning into a rout. A historic opportunity presented itself. As the British and Canadians picked up the attack on their front, Patton had open roads ahead of him, inviting his fast-moving armored columns to cut across the rear of the Germans, whose horse-drawn artillery and transport precluded rapid movement, encircle them, and destroy the German army in France. Then end the war with a triumphal, unopposed march across the Rhine and on to Berlin. Patton lusted to seize that opportunity. He had trained and equipped Third Army for just this moment. Straight east to Paris, then northwest along the Seine to seize the crossings, and the Allies would complete an encirclement that would lead to a bag of prisoners bigger than North Africa or Stalingrad. More important, it would leave the Germans defenseless in the west, because Patton could cut off the German divisions in northern France, Belgium, and Holland as he drove for the Rhine. That was the big solution. Obviously risky, if successful, it promised the kind of big encirclements the Wehrmacht had achieved in 1940 in France and 1941 in the Soviet Union. But neither Eisenhower nor Bradley were bold enough to take it. They worried about Patton's flanks. He insisted that the Yabos could protect them. They worried about Patton's fuel and other supply. He insisted that in an emergency they could be airlifted to him. Arguing over the merits of different generals is a favorite pastime of many military history buffs. It is harmless and often instructive, and we all have the right to pass judgment. That right comes from the act of participation. The American people had provided Generals Eisenhower and Bradley with a fabulous amount of weaponry and equipment, and some 2 million of their young men. There has to be an accounting of how well they used these assets to bring about the common goal. And how well means, did they achieve the victory at the lowest cost in the shortest time? Were they prudent where prudence was appropriate? More important, given their superiority over the enemy, did they take appropriate risks that utilized the greatest assets their country had given them, air power and mobility? In Normandy in August, the answer is no. Ike and Bradley picked the safer alternative, the small solution. Thus was a great opportunity missed. But of course we know now that the risk was worth taking, because we know the cost of finally overrunning Germany. In July 1944, Eisenhower and Bradley didn't. They were also responding to their obsession with ports. They wanted the small ports of Brittany, such as Saint-Malo, and the one big port, Brest. So they insisted that Patton stay with the pre-D-Day plan, with modifications. It had called for Patton to turn the whole of Third Army into Brittany. When he protested that being wedded to plans was a mistake and insisted that he wanted to attack toward Germany, not away from it, Eisenhower and Bradley relented to the extent that they gave him permission to reduce the Brittany attack to one corps, leaving two corps to head east. Eisenhower had often said that in war, plans are everything before the battle begins, but once the shooting started, plans were worthless. And back in 1926, when he had graduated first in his class at the Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, Patton had written to congratulate him, then to warn him to put all that Leavenworth stuff out of his mind from now on. "Victory in the next war," Patton had declared, "will depend on execution, not plans." To Patton, it was outrageous that his superiors wouldn't turn him loose. "I am also nauseated," he grumbled, "by the fact that Hodges and Bradley state that all human virtue depends on knowing infantry tactics." Patton thought that Omar the Tent Maker, as he called Bradley, was never audacious enough. "Bradley and Hodges are such nothings," he wrote. "Their one virtue is that they get along by doing nothing. They try to push all along the front and have no power anywhere." Monty agreed with Patton. He, too, wanted to abandon the plan to overrun Brittany. He pointed out the obvious. "The main business lies to the east." He pointed out the not-so-obvious. If the Allies seized the opportunity before them, Brest and Saint-Malo would not be needed. And indeed, in the event Saint-Malo held out to the end of the war, Hitler's orders, and Brest until late September. German destruction of the port facilities was so effective that it never made a significant contribution to the supply situation. An entire corps of well-trained, well-equipped tankers, infantrymen, and artillery had been wasted at a critical moment. In the boxing analogy, Patton wanted to throw a roundhouse right and get the bout over. His superiors ordered him to throw a short right hook to knock the enemy off balance. but the enemy already was staggering. He should have been knocked out. Although he was downcast by his superior's orders, Patton was exhilarated as his Third Army drove across France. He was at the front, in a jeep, escorted by an armored car, pushing, prodding, yelling, straightening out traffic jams, always demanding more. "Advance and keep on advancing," was his order. He was attacking in all four directions at once. "We are having one of the loveliest battles you ever saw," he wrote to an old friend. "It is a typical cavalry action, in which, to quote the words of the old story, the soldier went out and charged in all directions at the same time, with a pistol in each hand and a saber in the other." Still, he seethed. Attacking in every direction at once was fun, but he knew it was a fatal diminution of strength. The objective lay to the east, not north, west, or south. Hitler knew his army was staggering. Should it fall back? Get out of Normandy and across the Seine while the getting was good? That was what his generals wanted to do, because it made obvious military sense. But Hitler hated to retreat and loved to take risks. Where his generals saw the jaws of a trap closing on them, he saw a once-only opportunity to go for the American jugular. As Patton began his short right hook, swinging his divisions north toward Argentin, a glance at the map showed Hitler that the corridor through which Third Army received its supplies was exceedingly narrow, about 30 kilometers, and thus vulnerable. By bringing down more of the infantry and tankers of 15th Army from north of the Seine, Hitler told Kluge that he would have ample troops to cut that corridor. The process of bringing troops and tanks south of the Seine had been well started already, as Fortitude was wearing a bit thin by now. The tanks crossed the Seine by ferry after dark. It took the 116th Panzer Division 4 nights to complete the crossing. With these fresh troops, Hitler told Kluge, he could mount a full-scale counteroffensive, one designed to cut the Third Army supply line. It would start at Mortain, objective Avranches. Once the line had been cut, Patton could be destroyed in place, and the line restored. With luck, the Germans could force the fighting back into the hedgerow country, perhaps even drive the Americans back into the sea. Kluge and every soldier involved thought it madness. Beyond the problems of the Yabos and American artillery, these new divisions were not well equipped. Few Panthers or Tigers. They had fuel shortages, and anyway, they were not fresh troops. Major Heinz Gunther Guderian, son of the Colonel General, was with the 116th Panzer Division. He recalled, "Most of our people were old soldiers from the Eastern Front. Many of our wounded had returned. We also received parts of a training division, teenagers who had just been inducted and were not trained." Guderian went on dryly, "To begin an attack with the idea that it is without hope is not a good idea. We did not have this hope." Hitler ordered it done. Because Hitler mistrusted his generals, he took control of the battle, which forced him to use the radio, allowing Ultra, the British deciphering device, to reveal both the general plan and some of the specific details. So on August 5th, Eisenhower knew what was coming. 6 German armored divisions. Between them and Avranches stood 1 American infantry division, the 30th. Despite the numbers, no one in the American high command doubted that the 30th, supported by P-47 Thunderbolts and British Typhoons and American artillery, could hold. Far from telling Patton to stop, much less pull back, Eisenhower told him to keep moving. In Eisenhower's view, the Germans were sticking their heads in a noose. On the morning of August 7th, he flew to Normandy and set up an advance command post in Normandy, a tented headquarters in an apple orchard near Granville, where he had a grand view of Mont-Saint-Michel. He met with Bradley, who immediately agreed to hold Mortain with minimal forces, while rushing every available division south, through the corridor, and out into the interior. At the same moment, the German attack raced around and through Mortain. It had begun before dawn, tanks rolling forward through the night without the warning of an artillery preparation. It had achieved tactical surprise, and by noon was in Mortain. But the Germans could not dislodge the 700 men of the 2nd Battalion, 120th Infantry Regiment, 30th Division, from an isolated rocky bluff, Hill 317, just east of the town. The GIs on the hill had a perfect view of the surrounding countryside and forward observers with a radio communication system that allowed them to call in artillery and Yabos. The Germans had to take that hill before driving on to the coast. In their initial thrust, two SS Panzer divisions overran the 2nd Battalion CP and made the CO and his staff prisoner. Command on the hill reverted to Captain Reynold Erickson. As he got his men dug in, the forward observers worked their radios. Before dawn on the second day, August 8th, one of the observers, Lieutenant Robert Weiss, heard, more than he saw, a concentration of German tanks milling around at a roadblock set up by the GIs the previous night. He had the coordinates already fixed and called in a barrage. "That kept them away," Weiss reported. "Except for one tank which came through into our company territory, sniffing the dark like a nearsighted dragon. No other tanks followed. Our guys lay motionless, not a breath, not a sound. In the dark, the tank found nobody to fight. It turned and went back to its lair." With daylight, German 88s from their Panthers and anti-aircraft batteries began shelling the hill. At the top, there was a rocky ridgeline. Weiss crawled up to it and lifted his head. He had a panoramic view, but there was the great danger that the Germans would spot him as he spotted them, especially as the sun was coming up in his face and there was a reflection off his binoculars. But he also figured that the concept of range probable error would work in his favor. With all the variables involved, wind, elevation, distance, 1,500 to 2,000 meters, it was highly unlikely that the Germans could hit a target as small as his helmet. An 88, after all, was not a rifle. Of course, artillery shells don't have to score direct hits to kill. But Weiss further figured that shells hitting short of him would send their explosive power to the sides and over his head, while those that were long would fly overhead, miss the hill altogether, and hit at the base, and thus among the German troops down there. So Weiss sucked in his breath, called his radio operator forward, picked up his binoculars, and started crawling to the top of the crag. "We had to be quick," Weiss said. "The fire missions had to come with almost the speed of the shooting in a quick-draw Western, and with comparable accuracy." Sergeant Armin Sasser, tucked into the reverse slope, his antenna up, had his radio set up. "Ready, Lieutenant?" Weiss called Sergeant John Korn to move up beside him before scrambling up the precipice to the top. The sun glared. Head low, body flattened, elbows stretched far apart and resting on the ground, binoculars up to his face, just below his eyes, Weiss searched and waited. The Germans began firing, 88s and mortars. Weiss put his glasses to his eyes. Smoke from the muzzles of the German guns wreathed their position like smoke rings from a cigar, Weiss remembered. He called out to Sergeant Korn. "Fire mission, enemy battery," and gave the coordinates. Korn passed it on down to Sasser, who turned on his radio. "Crow, this is Crow Baker 3, fire mission," and repeated the coordinates. Weiss could only wait in apprehension. Who would fire first? I watched the enemy guns through my binoculars. Now a gun sight. Sasser called up softly. On the way. A freight train roared by from the left side, Weiss said. Almost instantly, clouds of smoke broke near the German position. I shouted an adjusting command to Korn, who passed it quickly to Sasser and on to battalion. The next salvos were right on target. That German battery was out of action. Shells came in from the left, from six enemy self-propelled guns. Weiss repeated the sequence, with similar satisfactory results. Then a single tank and yet another battery fired on Hill 317. The tank was to the south, the battery to the north. Weiss called in a barrage on the tank that set it ablaze, then turned his attention to the battery. Fire mission, enemy battery, six guns. Last concentration is 500 right, 300 short. The American shells fired in response came in online, but way short. Weiss shouted an adjustment over the noise of the enemy shells bursting around him. Korn passed it on. Tinkers to Evers to Chance, as Weiss put it. The follow-up rounds were on target. The enemy, Weiss noted with satisfaction, had been neutralized. Weiss called for some 30 fire missions during the course of the day, scrambling up the edge of the ridge each time the Germans began firing. Some half-dozen other observers were doing similar work that day. Even as the Mortain offensive began, Patton's forces had overrun Le Mans. The road to Paris, some 160 kilometers to the northeast, was a good one and was undefended. But instead of plunging ahead to Paris, the Americans turned to the northwest, toward Argentan, in pursuit of the short envelopment of the German armies in Normandy. Montgomery and Bradley agreed that the Americans should halt outside Argentan to await the Canadians, with the Polish 1st Armored Division in the lead, coming down from Falaise. When they met, the entire German army in Normandy, still attacking in the wrong direction at Hill 317, would be encircled. This decision has been much written about, lucidly and in detail, in Weigley's Eisenhower's Lieutenants, and in Max Hastings's Overlord, along with many others. Weigley sees a great opportunity lost by the Allies. Hastings sees a great victory won. The debate will continue. How it worked out for the GIs is the concern here. For the men of the 2nd Battalion of the 30th Division, it worked out that they were on their own. This, of course, encouraged the Germans to keep attacking in the wrong direction. By not reinforcing Hill 317, Bradley tempted the Germans to keep on pushing west. Of course, Hitler's orders to do so were explicit. How long could the men on the hill hold out? For 5 days, the hill was surrounded. While the Americans and Canadians were closing the envelopment behind them, the Germans continued the offensive. They threw tank columns into the attack on the hill. American artillery, responding to Lieutenant Weiss and the other observers, broke them up. On the second day, August 9th, something new. Bicycle troops. To Weiss, it was surrealistic. Innocence itself. The Krauts on bikes, rifles across their backs, pedaling along the country road as if on an outing. Then the American shells roared down on them, stopping that thrust. German light tanks tried again. Altogether, there were 5 attacks in the first hour that morning. Weiss, who had not eaten or slept for 48 hours, was operating on adrenaline. He was 21 years old and filled with the wonderful feeling that he was making a difference in a crucial battle. The frantic activity, shooting up tanks, troops, guns, and vehicles, even bicycles, cut through his fatigue and masked it. He was excited, even exhilarated. On the third day, still without rest, after shooting up yet another enemy column, he sent this message. As sleepy, tired, and hungry as I am, I never felt so good as I feel right now. The Germans could not just bypass Hill 317 because the observers were calling up to P-47s and British Typhoons whenever they saw tanks on the road. On the shoulders of their penetration, meanwhile, elements of the 4th, 9th, and 35th Divisions hammered the German flanks. As on Hill 317, forward observers on high ground called in fire missions. 18-year-old Private Robert Baldridge was in the 34th Field Artillery Battalion, 9th Division. He recalled, "The visibility from the top of this hill was excellent. What a change it was from the narrow confines of the hedgerows. We saw some 20 miles distant the outskirts of the city of Avranches, and even the spires of Mount Saint-Michel." Through the course of the 5-day battle, his team worked with the artillery to pound the enemy. "From our height, we could see many of our shells descending from the sky above as they whistled down." That was a new experience. The sounds were all different, too. With nightly German probes and attacks, we got to the point that we could quickly identify many different types of German vehicles. We knew which tanks were theirs and which ones were ours, at any distance. That day, the leading elements of the American forces got into Alençon. Argentan was but 20 kilometers to the northeast, but the GIs were meeting stouter German resistance because they were running into divisions on the march for Mortain, and because the Germans were awakening to their danger. Major Charles Cawthorn, an infantry battalion CO in Patton's army, recalled that this was not a game of Allied hounds coursing the German hare, as the press was reporting it, but rather the hunt after a wounded tiger into the bush, the tiger turning now and again to slash at its tormentors, each slash drawing blood. The Canadians were still short of Falaise. Kluge, meanwhile, was pleading with Hitler to allow him to retreat to the east while the gap was still open. On Hill 317, the position was precarious. No food, small arms ammunition running low, and worst of all, the batteries were dying. Without those radios, Weiss and his comrades were doomed. Sergeant Sasser began retrieving discarded batteries. During the day, he set them out on rocks. The hot sun warmed them up and restored some life. He switched batteries several times a day, restoring one set while using another, never using one for so long that it got run down to the point of no return. Even so, by the end of the 4th day, it was doubtful that he could keep them going. The battalion was out of rations. The GIs had long since cleaned out the chicken coops and rabbit pens around the half-dozen farms on the hill, along with the fruit and vegetable cellars, and were eating raw vegetables gathered from the gardens, when they got anything to eat. Medical supplies had long since run out. The artillery tried taking the explosives out of 105-millimeter shells and replacing them with morphine and penicillin, then firing them onto the hill for the men of the 2nd Battalion to retrieve. It didn't work. Everything got smashed when the shells hit. Airdrops of food, water, and ammunition were also a bust, as most of the supplies dropped by parachute came down behind the encircling enemy. After the 4th day, Weiss reported, "We could see no end." Incoming radio messages told the 2nd Battalion to hold on, help was coming. But when? The 4th night was the longest. Artillery and mortar fire came down from all directions. Around 0300, a German light tank started up the ridge, stopping less than 50 meters from the top. The GIs crouched low, scarcely breathing, rifles at the ready, not moving one inch. The tank fired once, twice. The muzzle blasts lit up the sky. Shrapnel and rocks flew through the air. The German tank commander lifted his turret, pushed his head through the opening, and called out in good English, "Surrender or die!" No one moved. He called again. One GI threw down his rifle, ran to the tank, and climbed on. Everyone else stood fast. After a few minutes, the turret clanged shut, the tank backed off, and the disgusted and angry German faded into the darkness, carrying his sole prisoner. Lieutenant Ralph Curley commanded E Company of the 2nd. After 4 days and nights of fighting off the Germans, he was exhausted, but he kept at his work. At mid-morning of the 5th day, studying the panorama below him through his binoculars, he spotted a German mortar crew served by a half-dozen men. "Sergeant," he called out to the leader of his own mortar team, "how many rounds do you have left?"
"One, sir."
Curley paused, thought about what relief it would bring if he could put that mortar out of action, thought about the danger he would be in if he was out of shells.
"You think you can hit the son of a bitch?"
"Yes, sir, I reckon I can."
"Then blow his ass off."
The red-headed sergeant gathered up his crew and brought the 60-millimeter mortar barrel, the base plate, and the rest of the assembly forward. Curley watched the enemy mortar crew. He saw them loafing, lying around, sunbathing, laughing. Occasionally one man would stroll back into the bushes and emerge with a shell, drop it down the tube, and shortly thereafter the shell would explode to the right or left, showering Curley with rocks and dirt. Curley studied his map, turned to the sergeant, pointed, and said, "Put it right here." The sergeant nodded, made his own survey with his binoculars, made the adjustments. A private, his M1 rifle slung across his back, clutched the sole remaining mortar shell for dear life against his belly. Another consultation. Curley and the sergeant talked quietly about wind, distance, elevation. More adjustments on the elevating screw. One last consultation, one final minor adjustment. Satisfied, the sergeant nodded to Curley, who nodded back. The sergeant turned to the rifleman with the mortar shell and held out his hands. The private, with great care, stretched his hands out to the sergeant as if passing off a newborn baby. The sergeant took the shell, kissed it, lifted it to the end of the barrel, dropped it in, ducked, and called out, "On the way!" Curley steadied his glasses, peering intently, holding his breath. He watched the gray-green uniformed enemy soldiers loafing around. Kaboom! The shell exploded less than 10 meters from the enemy mortar team. Two of the men leapt up and ran away. Another tried to get up, fell down, rose again, and staggered away. Two others dashed out from the bushes, grabbed their mortar, and ran. Curley started breathing again.
"Nice work, Sergeant," he called out.
On August 11th, Kluge finally got Hitler's permission to break off the attack at Mortain and begin the retreat through the Falaise Gap. It was a momentous, if inevitable, decision. It cost Kluge his job and shortly thereafter his life at his own hand. His replacement was Field Marshal Walter Model. Because once the retreat began, there was no place to stop, turn, and defend short of the Siegfried Line at the German border. The line of the Seine could not be defended. There were too many bends in the river, too many potential crossing places to defend. Once the retreat began, the Battle of France had been won. In fact, did not even have to be fought, thanks to the Battle of Normandy. In assessing the failure of the Mortain attack, Major Heinz Gunther Guderian said in an interview, "It was due to air power. We were very impressed by the American Air Force, by artillery, and by the excellent fighting of their infantry, which surprised us. There is no doubt about that." At 14:30, on the 5th day of the siege of Hill 317, August 12th, the 35th Division broke through the German lines, even as the enemy was making preparation to withdraw, and relieved the 2nd Battalion on Hill 317. Of the 700 GIs on the hill, some 300 were dead, including Sergeant Korn, or wounded. Lieutenant Weiss had called in 193 fire missions while the battalion had been surrounded. After eating and getting some sleep, he wrote his after-action report on a typewriter, hunting and pecking, striking over. It was 10 pages long. On the last morning, Weiss concluded there was a lot of movement below him, and we commenced firing in earnest. Still, the enemy attacked, but it never attained momentum because of the devastating artillery fire. He seemed to have vacated the area by the time the dust cleared. For hours after, we could see smoke in the draw to the front from burning vehicles, and the east-west road was strewn with wreckage. Summing up what he had learned from his 5-day ordeal, Weiss wrote, "Although quite often beat back and silenced at the slightest carelessness in exposing ourselves thereafter, the enemy would strike back at us. He doesn't quit. His aggressiveness demands a 24-hour observation, whether by sight or sound." That observation should have been printed up and distributed to all troops, but it wasn't. Then Weiss wrote a letter to his father. "Not much to write about from here."
This ends Disc 3.